Welcome to the newest episode of the Little House Book Club. The Little House Book Club is family-friendly and listener-supported, which means no commercials. If you would like to share your thoughts or suggest a book or author, please email me at mark@walnutgrovecast.com. Today I have a very special guest. Her name is Robin Elizabeth Miller. She's an author, speaker, editor, and writing coach. Robin has authored 8 books, which include From the Mouth of Ma, about Caroline Ingalls, Pioneer Mixology, The Three Faces of Nellie, which is a biography of the three women who made up the character of Nellie Olson from a TV show you might have heard of, Little House on the Prairie. Her podcast, The Art of Semi-Fiction, explores every corner of the written word, and you can find out more about her podcast at theartofsemifiction.com. Please welcome to the show, Robin. How are you doing?
Thank you, Mark. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to do this. And I'm amazed that I get along with, I would say, almost everybody. Well, I'd say everybody so far who writes about the world of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Everybody is so nice.
I think it's a pretty good club to be in.
That's a good way to put it.
So you do.
We need a patch.
I think we do. And I want a salute and a handshake. That's what I keep telling everybody.
The LIWs.
Exactly.
So I guess first and foremost, did you always have a love for Laura Ingalls Wilder's books?
I did. I was one of those who my kind of love affair with the whole Ingalls family and just the pioneer period of America started when I was very young. I was one of those precocious early readers. Mm-hmm. And I was able to read by 3, by 5, I was reading Laura's books. And that's a little young to start. I wasn't starting with the easier, chapter books that are now out. It was the full books. And I would sit there sometimes with a flashlight under my covers with the book and a dictionary because I didn't understand all of the words yet. Mm-hmm. That I could read them. I just didn't know what they meant. And from the very beginning, I was absolutely captivated. So I'm one of those who were infected very young with my love of Laura and her family.
Yeah, that's really interesting that, I think sometimes we do remember this period of time when we're little and we're reading something and you might be struggling with the material, but you are trying so hard and you need to understand what's on the page. And, it's just, you might read it, 3 or 4 times, or you just kind of go over it, you ask questions, and it's something that I kind of miss about reading these days, is having that. I mean, I love reading. It's just having this, I guess, putting the blinders on and having nothing else in your life for that moment except for that book in front of you.
Exactly.
I started reading her books in probably 3rd or 4th grade. So after you, definitely. But they were the first books that I fell in love with. They're the ones that kind of clicked for me and got me to even care about reading. So that's why they're special to me.
And I think that's I love that you're a man who feels that way. My youngest son, like 6 months ago, I think he said this. He said, because I was going to sign some books and do some things at some little house sites, and we made it into a family vacation and took him to, among other places, Almanzo's home in Malone. Mm-hmm. And so I said I wanted him to read, because he'd kind of, some boys look at it and go, bonnets,
Right. It's a girl show. That it's a show. It's a girl's story. That's what
exactly
told to us.
And we, but we, a friend of mine is Wendy Lou Lee, who played Baby Grace on the television show. Mm-hmm. And he met her and he loves Wendy. And so he kind of softened because of Wendy a little bit toward it. But I said, if we're going to go to these sites, I want you to read the books, because it makes it more engaging with any historical site that you go to. Sure. To have some background and some personal connection. So the first place that we were at was the farm in Malone. And I had him read Farmer Boy. Mm-hmm. And his statement to me, That was now a couple of years ago, but his statement to me about 6 months ago is, you realize, Mom, you used Farmer Boy as a gateway drug. Once I read that, I was so hooked then he read all the rest of the series on his own volition. And I think that that's kind of one of the things that some people don't realize is how much a boy, and you know, my son's all boy, you know, he played soccer and baseball, and you know, he's just, he loves it. He yeah. loves the adventure. He loves the description. He loves the undertones of self-sufficiency, all those things. There's a lot for guys to get a hold of. And, but I think it was funny that he called Farmer Boy a gateway drug. I don't know what Laura would think about that.
I think it's a fair comparison. Also Almanzo's love of donuts can be a bit of a gateway drug.
Well, exactly. Well, just the description. I think that this is, if there's nothing else to attract boys, at least teenage boys, it's the level of food and food description.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing what she describes and how she describes things. I might, you know, this particular child would have the book in one hand and he'd be going to the kitchen because every, you know, she wrote, especially in Farmer Boy, there's so much food in it in contrast to what appears in the other books. But there's still wonderful food in the other books, but there was definitely a marked intentional contrast.
I didn't notice the donuts so much. This one woman I do a podcast with, her name is Kelly Milkey. She just pointed out, and I just couldn't not see it. Because I read the book maybe a few weeks after she pointed it out. I'm like, donut, 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 donut.
Yeah.
He donuts had a jar pockets, of donuts. And I was like, too many donuts.
Yeah, I'm telling you, exactly. And of course, that's not something that teenage boys will say no to. So,
so I noticed you used the correct pronunciation, Almanzo.
Yes.
Which, but I'm sure you heard of Almanzo, which comes from the TV show, and I'm wondering yes. what your thoughts of the television show is.
It's funny. I'm when I speak, I often get this question because there does seem to be an interesting little rift in those who are very protective of the TV show mm-hmm. and those who are very staunchly book only. The rest is Hollywood and it's all rubbish. And I kind of think that they're both pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I believe that is the number of people that I speak to who would never have picked up Laura's book if it wasn't for the TV show, would never have been introduced to the real Laura and her real family and her real journey if it wasn't for that TV show. It's a lot of people. And I think that you can have something very special that isn't exactly accurate in a variety of ways, as long as you're aware of it. That's kind of my thing. When I have people come up and to me, like when I'm signing books and they say, oh, I'm just such a fan of the books. I just loved it when Albert was adopted. And, you know, and you're like, ah, you know, that's when I start, you know, eye twitching and things, because I can look at and watch Little House on the Prairie, the TV show, and enjoy it for what it was.
Sure.
And really just love it. But I do that with the background that knowing that once they left the pilot, they pretty much left the whole series. I mean, really, the names are the same. And I mean, the fact that they didn't even stay in Walnut Grove, you know, I mean, there's just so many non-historical aspects to that show. So if you get your mind around that and accept it for what it is, it's a wonderful show. And I'm not that snooty. I'm first and foremost the books lover. That is where my passion and my heart is.
Sure.
But I kind of liken it to Mexican food and Taco Bell. If you think Taco Bell is authentic Mexican food, then come to my house and I will help you out and I will take you to some proper places.
Taco Bell invented by a man named Glenn Bell.
You know,
a white guy.
You just have to, if you know that Taco Bell is just Taco Bell,
yeah,
then you don't start comparing it to a proper, you know, carne asada street taco or something.
Yeah. You don't go ask for
take
a chalupa.
It for what it is and enjoy it or you don't enjoy it. And that's kind of my comparison. I personally think that the books are Mexican food, authentic Mexican food. And I think that the show is Taco Bell in that it's not the authentic thing, but I think it's pretty darn good. Actually, it's one of my favorite fast foods. So that's how I deal with that issue of the books versus the TV people. And I kind of wish that there was a little bit less animosity about it. a little bit, because I think that one of the things that the Little House community by and large does is bring people together. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate those who are very protective of the books and the history and the reality of what happened and who Laura was. But I think it's okay. I don't think you're doing any damage loving Little House 2.
Yeah, I think it's all part of the same universe, and I just feel like we have to kind of accept it and move on. I'm a big fan of the TV show, and I grew up watching it, so I really think that it really helped create many more eyes on the books. And I don't know if the book series would be as popular without the TV series. It would still be around, of course, but I just have to wonder if it would be as popular. Just not sure. Could be.
Yeah. Can't go back and figure it out, but I'm with you. I think that it's really driven a lot of people to the real Laura. And I think for that alone, it has value, but I also think it's an enjoyable show.
Now, I'm going to assume it's your love is what is inspiring the writing of these books. But when did you decide to finally write one of these books? Where you're like, you know, question. What? I just need to create. You know, I need to create a new book about this.
I think what happened is I'm one of those who rereads the series every year, mm-hmm. multiple times, sometimes multiple times a year. It's a rich series. And so you always pick up things, and the more you read them, the more questions arise. The more you feel connected to the characters, you wonder what happened to Mr. and Mrs. Bose. You wonder what happened here and what happened there. Mm-hmm. And I think those questions kind of rose up. And when I got married, my husband, who I've mentioned to you in another conversation,
yes.
that he's British, and he. Did I think he was a little unaware of how passionate a redheaded American woman could be about a series of books until he met me. And then, of course, for years, he bought me every single book or show or anything related to Little House for every anniversary, birthday, Christmas,
nice.
Everything, until it was exhausted. And I devoured him. I devoured all of them. And then I realized there's still some holes here in the canon of research and in history. So I was just starting my master's of fine arts in writing. Mm-hmm. And one of my teachers said something about, obviously you hear this, if you're in all writing communities, write what you know or write what you're passionate about. So obvious, it was an obvious connection to me. And that just kind of spurred me on to think, what would I want to know? What can I give to this community, answer questions that, I have. And one of my big things, my big book, and probably the one that in Little House that I'm most known for, is The Three Faces of Nellie. I really wanted Nellie's character, and I knew already from my other reading that she was a composite character of three women, but I wanted her to grow up and like dig wells in Africa and adopt orphans and, yeah. Foster puppies. I really wanted a good redemption story, but I was super curious to see what happened to those women. So my curiosity already myself, my desire to add something to the canon of research that was out there was also a driving force. And then of course I had opportunity to do it of a great, wonderful husband who's very supportive of my slight addiction to Laura and all things Laura.
Healthy addiction.
So those things all moved together. And so I started researching and writing that book. And of course I had other opportunities. I actually had to do From the Mouth of Ma was actually never really meant to actually get the press that it has. Because I wrote it while I was trying to pitch The Three Faces of Nellie.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I was told that there was no market for a Little House. There was no Little House community. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm pretty sure there is because I'm a part of it. Right. And so I was really shocked because the definition of a niche market is just that it has a narrow focus. It doesn't mean that it's a small market. And considering how many people all over the world are still watching the TV show and how many millions of books are sold every year, it's still one of the top selling books every year. Yeah. The series and the individual books all combined, it's just shocking how many fans that there are. So I wrote it more as a marketing exercise. And because I was learning at the same time that dialogue is really an interesting way of showing a reader developing a character. And I thought it was kind of interesting after having read the books a million times that Ma spoke a lot in Proverbs and scripture and, you know, just kind of sayings, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, Pa's over there giving bear hugs and, right. you know, talking in real dialogue and Ma's kind of spouting Proverbs. So I thought that was an interesting thing just as a case study of how Laura developed her Ma's character through that kind of writing mechanism. Mm-hmm. But I put it together fairly quickly, and it really needs a good edit, actually, to show that there was a market, and that happened to be the year that Pamela Smith Hill's annotated auto, you know, Pioneer.
Oh, yes, girl, yes, the Pioneer Girl came out. Annotated, yes.
Yeah, came out the same year, and my book got, you know, one of those, if you buy this, buy that kind of thing.
Nice, you know, the algo.
And so, yeah, my book that I didn't mean for, I just wanted it to kind of show enough that there was a market. I didn't really need it to go beyond that. And of course, it kind of went a little bit crazy. So, but that was good because that funded my MFA. So that worked out well. That worked out well for me.
Yeah, there's definitely a market.
I think that's just it. You get connected to something and you want to add something to what's already out there was pretty much my motivation.
There's definitely a tremendous, I mean, you've learned this, you proved them wrong, is there is a tremendous fan base.
Huge.
For the books as well as the TV show. And it's just, there is. And, you know, I started Walnut Grovecast like 4 years ago as a joke. You know, it was a show I grew up with. A friend of mine just kind of, him and I just said, like, you know what we should do is make a Little House on the Prairie podcast. And we did. And next thing you know, we have like thousands of listeners. And now there's a lot. There's a lot of listeners. I'm very fortunate. And I love the listeners. They're really very active. It's a very interactive type of relationship that I have with the listeners. And then I started these other things because I think that the books need to be spoken about and the books written about that are important. Because I do think that, you know, your books are just as important as the original books. I mean, all of these books really are together for a reason. They're all about each other. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. And like I said, I've personally been getting along with everybody who I deal with, whether it be multiple, like somebody who's way out of my generation, like Barbara Walker, the writer of the cookbook, mm-hmm. Or even, you know, people on the TV show like Dean Butler. You know, it's like everybody is just so nice. I haven't had any negative experiences. Yeah. And I've had the opportunity to speak to quite a lot of people. And, you know, we were just talking about Annette Whipple. Like, lovely. Yeah. You know, just a wonderful person.
I think that's part of the draw, too. Not only is it's an interesting, I love the time period.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that period of history. I'm absolutely in love with Laura and her family and all the real people there. But it fosters a community you want to be a part of. I have to tell you a quick story that just scared the bejeebies out of me, though. I went to Laura Palooza for the first time to speak.
That does sound scary. No,
what?
It does sound scary.
It was a little. It was a little because these are like no joke people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they know their stuff. They're going to an academic, even though it's Laura Palooza, you know, sounds like it's going to be a fun time in bonnets. It's not. It's a serious academic conference.
And yeah, you don't want to make a mistake and say Almanza.
And I got put between William Anderson, and now I can't remember who the other person was. Anyway, I got put kind of on a heavy hitter's day.
Yeah, like William Anderson, like serious heavy hitter. Yeah.
And I had to follow him, right?
Can I call you Bill? You know,
I'm already going because I'm watching and I'm looking at, you know, I'm at the conference too, so I'm listening to all the speakers. And if somebody made a mistake, the whole crowd knew it. They knew it. And there was a couple people who were,
oh my God,
you know, explaining kind of scientific things and whatever, you know, different things. And they made some mistakes according to the book. They were absolutely you know, they're physicists or something. So they were great on their actual topic, but they did not know something about the book. And to look in the crowd was kind of hysterical, like, ah, these people knew their stuff.
It's like the so Gong Show.
Hugh Anderson gets up there, and he's brilliant. You know, he's a really nice man. And brilliant, does a great job. But at one point, he actually said Almanzo.
He might have done it on purpose.
And the crowd all collectively gasped. And I thought, oh, no, you didn't just gasp at William Anderson. If he's, you know, and they all looked at him like, how could you possibly not know? I'm like, he is William Anderson and he's a human being.
That's so
funny. He said Almanzo the rest of the time. But one time he slips and it was like a bunch of piranhas were in the water. And
that's
I thought,
so funny.
I suddenly have something else I need to do. I don't think I need to go up and talk to you all about Millie.
He's another guy, just an incredible, incredible part of this whole crazy universe of Little House.
Yes.
So you bring up the culture and the love of 19th century everything. You also focused a bit on 19th century foods. Is this something that you have a personal interest in? Do you kind of cook with cast iron and
yes, like I do all that. I mean, and that's my love of cooking and my love of preserving foods started with Little House. To learn how to make cheese, because that was one of the things that I thought Laura was brilliant about. She didn't just say, "Yeah, we made cheese," when the milk was flowing in the summer. She described the process. She described the process of making jerky and brining hams and all the things that they did to preserve the foods. That fascinated me. So I make my. In fact, I actually capture my own wild yeast and to make my sourdough bread. Wow. I don't just get it from a packet somewhere. I can and I do a lot of smoked meats and fish and things. I do all that, all because of Little House. But one of the things that when you're doing research on something, you can't help but learn other things. And the book Pioneer Mixology, which is kind of half, it's got recipes and stuff in it, but it's got a lot of history in it about how the evolution of the West impacted the evolution of beverages too. And I found out just an interesting fact as I was looking at a manifest of pioneers that were going west, basically a manifest of what they should have per person for the journey. And I noticed that man, woman, and child, they needed a certain percentage of poundage of coffee. And I'm like, I wonder how many cups of coffee that makes. And so I did the research on that. And I found out after a bunch of rabbit trails that man, woman, and child, that was 6 to 8 cups of coffee a day, including little kids. And of course, I needed to know why we were not just boiling water for those poor kids, right? Why we were having a 4-year-old drinking 6 to 8 cups of coffee. And in the process of learning that, I learned that even on the trail, while they're cooking over buffalo, dried buffalo patties, they were clarifying their coffee often just because they don't like cloudy coffee. Mm. And that was interesting to me. So that led down another rabbit trail I was trying to find the why of it, where that started. But of course, I got more of the how they did it through putting in eggshells and other things. And then that led me to the fact that isinglass was used. And isinglass is a swim bladder of a sturgeon. Who the heck was the first person to say, I've got cloudy coffee. I don't want cloudy coffee. So let me put in, a dried piece of a sturgeon fish. It just made no sense to me.
Right.
So that's how it kind of, my love of the food was, I'd start somewhere and then I just would go down a rabbit trail and that would lead me to other questions. And it led me to the four pioneer little, they're just mini recipe books. My slightly and super series. So there's two books that are slightly strange pioneer recipes, one sweet, one savory, and ones that are super simple pioneer recipes in savory and simple, because I just collected all this information as I was doing research for other projects and other books. So it just rabbit trail. You get going in history and it's just going to, you're going to see, spot some weird
and you learn so many other things. While you go down that, I should say rabbit trail. I tend to say rabbit hole, but when you go down these, when you follow these, you learn so many other things. And then, it's crazy. Did you ever learn why it was appropriate for coffee? Like so much coffee.
Well, the funny thing is, no, I never, there was the the water on the trail being boiled. But again, I don't know why we can't just boil water, cool it down, and give it to a kid in a cup. Never, ever found that out. And the origin of, or the rabbit trail or the rabbit hole of the isinglass, I discovered that winemakers use it to clarify wine. Yeah. But again, I want to know who was just carrying a bunch of dried swim bladders from a sturgeon fish past an open vat of wine, tripped, chucked it in, noticed that it was clear, and that became standard. You know, there's a stoppage that happens.
It's interesting.
And I have no idea where you go past it, but I'm still looking for the information. So if anybody knows why children would be drinking that many cups of coffee on a trail, please let me know.
It's like, shut up, you know. I make my own wine, and I use it's a shellfish that you clarify it with. It's a type, and it's why a kosher wine will not be able to be clear. You know, if it's a non-kosher wine, it needs to be clarified in a different process. Nowadays there's all these other things, but I'm not really sure what kosher wine was clarified with.
Well, but who was the first person to think, I really can't drink cloudy wine, and oh, I have dried swim bladders of fish, you know?
Yeah, like, it's gross.
Who put those things together? When I'm cooking, I don't think I'm going to add dried parts of fish to, you know, my coffee or something to make it better. It just doesn't seem like it's going to go.
And what else did they try that didn't work?
I know. I'm afraid of that. Because the things, if you look in the slightly strange recipes, some of the things that people put together, like really, like legitimately, I think who was the first person to decide this is a good idea, and how many other mistakes did you make on the way to this? I have no idea.
Right, it's like float some hair in the coffee and it'll clarify. Maybe it's like,
exactly.
I don't think so.
Ugh.
Not happening. It's not yet. But yeah, I have a love of 19th century foods and the process of cooking and cooking outdoors. I think it's an amazing thing. And I think it's a little bit, you know, people are getting back into it. Maybe they never really stopped doing it. There's always been this love. I think the internet has also opened the doors to learn and share a lot of this stuff. And
when I was blogging, it's a long time ago, my little prairie home. I did a recipe for making bacon from scratch, and that happened. One of the kids that we adopted had a lot of nutritional issues and couldn't have nitrates or nitrites. So I just learned how to make bacon from scratch, and it still to this day gets thousands and thousands of views. But it's so easy, and people always think, "Oh, you make your bacon from scratch." I'm like, "I'm not making the pig. I'm just curing the bacon, in a different way, and it's healthier because of that." But it's amazing how many people, when they realize that a lot of the food preservation techniques and the recipes and the things that they used back then were actually not that difficult to do.
Absolutely.
With limited, because they didn't have all the fancy canners and all the things that we do now. And the result is amazing. So all the people in the pandemic who've learned how to make sourdough bread, they will never be able to buy a loaf and go, you know, this is worth my $6 to pay for this loaf of bread when I could have made it for 50 cents and it would have been better. You know,
I
think the pandemic has actually helped people to have the time to look into some of these things. And it's kind of, I agree with you. I don't think it's ever stopped, but I think it's had a resurgence over the last year and a half, that people are learning what they can do at home, how easy it is, how easy, cooking from home and freezing things is, you know, cheaper and better tasting than buying prepackaged meals to pull out of the freezer. I think food has actually come back into its own a little bit over the last year and a half. So
yeah, I ferment
pickles. One silver lining.
I'm saying I make my own fermented pickles, lacto-fermented, and I swear, like, pretty much you can't screw this up. It's once you get past it and you get, you know, like, measuring everything, you know, so perfectly, after a few times you just think, you know what, I'm just going to put in this much salt and then a few of these and just, I'm not going to worry so much about this. And they come out just as good, if not better. So we overthink
it. I'm absolutely with you.
So could you talk a little bit more about The Three Faces of Nellie Olson? It's just, I love the title of the book because it really, for one, you know you're about to learn so much about about this character who's a single character, but you're going to learn about the birth of this character based upon three people.
Yeah.
I love it.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I love the whole concept of that. It's perfect.
Oh, thank you. I mean, like I said, I had known that she was a composite character. I did not know before doing the research to what extent which character or which real life character impacted the composite character. But I knew there were three women, and I just found it, you know, it was interesting because I did want to know what happened to these women. And I like a good redemption story. So I really did hope that they had grown out of their kind of meanness and turned into wonderful, nice people.
Right.
As it turned out, that was not the case. But along the way, again, I found out interesting things that just drove me on and on. Two of the women, Genevieve Masters and Nellie Owens, Kiri, they really were the personality drivers mm-hmm. behind the inherent meanness of Nellie. And they really did kind of continue that on. They were pieces of work, as my grandma would say, in
wow.
a very nice, polite way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stella Gilbert was the third one. And I think her major flaw to Laura was far more that she was also interested in Almanzo.
Yeah.
And really her only sort of contribution to the character was the buggy ride.
Yeah, wouldn't she take rides with them?
She kind of weaseled her way into it, hoping to, you know, squeeze Laura out a little bit. I don't think that her personality was, I think it was more Genevieve's personality, but I think it was the circumstance of the buggy ride that really was how Stella kind of became one of the three Nellies. But really, I don't think she was. I think
such
she was
a Nellie.
Fairly decent human being, but yeah. Boy, Nellie Owens, when they left, never saw Laura after Walnut Grove. Her family moved with her brother Willie and her parents moved out. Actually, they ended up in Ferndale, California, from Walnut Grove, and that is where my family's from.
Oh,
and my great grandparents were dairy farmers. And they would have been literally going to dairy men's meetings, cattlemen meetings, and things at the exact same time that they were. So there's no way that my great grandparents couldn't have known Nellie's parents and
wow.
Nellie's family, which I didn't know until I did the research. I had no idea, but that was a really interesting connection. The other thing that I didn't know is the Bedalls, who kind of got morphed into Mrs. Beadle. There were another family in the area in Walnut Grove, and the father died. Mother farmed out the kids to a variety of neighbors because she couldn't support them all. And when the Owens decided to move west, they had the youngest, Frank Bedall, the youngest kid in their family. It was Frank Bedall, and they'd been caring for him. And they basically gave this six-year-old kid, and his mom also gave him this kid a decision. He could either go with the Owens out west and pretty much never see his family again, or he could stay there and be near his brothers and sisters and mom. And he chose to go with the Owens. And I can't believe that they put that on a six-year-old. But they did, and he went. And from that point, he was effectively, not officially, their adopted child. So I found that interesting because, you know, I'm a mom who's adopted and fostered kids. So right. I thought that was interesting. And then Genevieve was the one who basically was her high school years, her older years. All the Dismet kind of nastiness was mostly attributed to her, even though she was also known in Walnut Grove as well. But very, very kind of nasty character. And Stella moved out to Washington State. Nellie moved out to the West Coast, first to California, then up to Tillamook, Oregon. And I've actually moved up not too far. So I'm now living near where she died and isn't buried, and Willie's buried. So I have a lot more ability to research things in a little closer, with a closer view. And Genevieve moved out to the West Coast as well at one point. She was married to William Renwick, who was a hotshot banker, and he ended up committing fraud. He embezzled, got put in prison. And they moved back to, after his prison term, they moved back to Chicago. And so they would have stayed out here if he hadn't been caught, but he did. And so All of them, all three Nellies ended up on the West Coast, which I found interesting.
They're and big stories, moves, too.
Again, I was hoping for redemption, but there were fascinating stories.
I think redemption would be nice, but at the same time, having these really colorful, true stories to go along with it are, I mean, it just adds so much more depth to the history.
And you know what? Here's something that I also... it kind of redeemed Laura a little bit for me.
Yeah, and maybe she.
I mean, really, this is going to sound kind of weird because I was a tomboy when all growing up, and I just did not get girl drama. I really did not get girl drama, and I thought, is Laura just being kind of a catty girl? You know, is she being just a little bit unfair? You know, kind of. And Nellie Owens Keery, she was. I mean, I think that Genevieve was a piece of work in a different way, but Nellie Owens Keery did things that just boggled my mind as an adult. And one of them, for example, she marries her husband, Henry Keery, and within months of them marrying, she secretly files on a claim as a single woman. She's trying to get land duplicitously without ever telling him. She did all sorts of dealings that he never knew. And when they divorced, he thought that they only had one marital home. And she was claiming, you know, that, oh, she's so poor and destitute and things. But she had been, since the first months of their marriage, she had been hiding transactions and dealings from him and property from him. So she was just selfish and mean and weird all the way through her life. And so in a way that kind of made me feel like, well, maybe Laura had something, right? Maybe she was actually, she could have been being kind to both, you know, Genevieve and Nellie and painting them nicer than they were, because both of them, I just feel like were not great adults. They didn't make great moral choices. And they were just mean.
That's
they were
amazing.
Just kind of mean. So
I think it's wild because, you know, they could have just, you know, had kids, moved on. That's it. You kind of fade away into obscurity.
Which is what Stella did. Yeah. Stella just went and moved. And, you
but
know,
these other two, they had the crescendo. They're like, we're going to one up it each time. They were more like Alison Arngrim's Nellie than anything, right?
Exactly. And we all look at that. I mean, Alison, I mean, her classic, iconic caricature of Nellie is just brilliant from a TV character point of view.
Sure.
But I don't think anybody of us would be like, really? You know, is there somebody that's naughty? Is there, you know?
It's actually worse.
Yeah, I think you find out, well, actually, I think Alison probably could have gone further with it. You know, she turned nice. Percival got hold of her and she suddenly turned into a decent human. And I don't think that happened with at least two of the Nellies. So yeah, it was very interesting to read the choices that they made, the duplicity that happened, you know, and it's not just guessing, it's in land documents and things. I've looked
at
a lot of information, and she's, you know, she lied when she was divorced. She was she lived in Portland when she died, and she, a couple places that she lived in the censuses there, the city and the national, she said that she was a widow. And I understand that in some locations there was stigma. Portland at the time there wasn't. All the other women all around her in the lodgings that she had that were saying that they were divorced, and she would have known that, and she chose to lie. So poor Henry, you know, being killed, and he's alive and kicking.
Wow.
So it was just kind of interesting to see that to her dying day, she was still very Nellie-esque. Very Nellie-esque.
So what is next for you? What do you have any projects that you're working on? You seem like the type of person who has projects.
I do have projects. I have multiple projects. And one, I cannot tell. I'm contractually obligated until we...
come on, it's me. No, I'm kidding.
A publishing timing issue.
Yeah.
And I can't name what it is, but I can give some hints, and that's what I'm going to do. It is definitely another Little House book.
Wonderful.
It addresses probably one of my favorite characters, of whom not much has been written about, definitely not written about, a little bit of speculation. But it's going to be, it is probably the best research. There's been three researchers, well, me and two others involved in it. And it is, I think the citations pages are enough to fill a book. It is the best research project I've ever been involved with, because it is such, it's one of those Laura questions that has so much conflicting information. So that is supposed to come out in November.
That sounds very exciting. That's a great teaser right there. I hope that we can trick you into coming on here when it finally is being published.
I would love to, because of this whole pandemic thing, and of course a lot of publishers and things have had issues. My tongue has been bitten in half over the last year and a half, and it's been very frustrating. But I think we're almost there, because I can't wait to share it.
It's perfectly timed, in my opinion.
Again, I felt very passionate about. I saw a big hole in the canon of history and research. And I'm excited to be able to bring this project, and I hope it's gonna. I hope whenever I do write something that it just adds to things. I don't think if we find another pile of letters from somewhere, maybe some of the things that are in Nelly are going to be clearer. I don't ever feel like, well, I've written something and nobody needs to ever research it anymore. I feel like it should be the beginning of the conversation. I want people to add to the canon of information that we have. And so I just feel like I'm a part of that. And hopefully this book will be a part of answering some questions, but opening others. And maybe somebody else will be able to answer those questions. They will have a piece of the puzzle they didn't realize was valuable. So that's part of my excitement in putting a book out like this, is even though it's incredibly well-researched, we're not 150 years ago. We're now. So some of the research is, we have to just go with period sources, which we all know are not always accurate. So if it draws more information out of the woodwork from as a response to this book, then I say that that's wonderful. But it was an incredible lot of fun to write and to research. So that is the next Little House project. And it should, like I said, it should be available in November, and I will know that probably in the next month or so. And as soon as I get the green light, I will happily announce.
The name of the book, Michael Enden is Charles Ingalls. Time traveler.
Wouldn't that be?
No, I don't.
wouldn't that be? Mike, no, Pa Ingalls did actually go around without a shirt on. That's actually the title.
There you go. He waxed his chest, But, Robin, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. It was really a delight, and I love hearing all of the stories of research and everything, all the work that you've put into this. I hope you realize that the fans of the entire genre really do appreciate the work of researchers like you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's one of those, I'm very blessed to be able to do the thing that I love that then also hopefully brings a little bit of joy to other people. It's kind of a win-win-win. I feel very fortunate to be able to be writing. And again, I write other things besides this. So I am a career writer and speaker and teacher. So I'm very blessed to be able to do that. It's just wonderful to be immersed in the people and the time period that I love.
Now, your podcast, again, is called The Art of Semi-Fiction, and you can find it at theartofsemifiction.com. Is that the best place to follow your career? Or if people want to find out more about you, where would be the best?
At robinmiller.com. So robinmiller.com. That's probably the best place. That's my personal website and information about where I'll be. It's been a weird, as we all know, it's been a weird year. So the last year I have not spoken as much or taught, but we're opening up in 2022, things are moving. So that'll be where I'm going to be, where, what new projects are happening. I'm the director of a writing conference. So, information about that, all sorts of different things, are on that page.
That's awesome.
That's probably the best source.
I'll put a link to all of that in the show notes and on our website and everything, including links to purchase any of the books that you've written. But again, Robin, I want to thank you so much. It was really a pleasure, and I hope you return anytime, really. But I mean, I would definitely want to hear. I definitely want to hear more about this secret project. Thank you for listening to the Little House Book Club. If you enjoy Little House on the Prairie and the history that surrounds it, you might want to take a listen to Wanak Grovecast as well as the Bonnet Heads podcast. All of my podcasts are family friendly and listener supported.
Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight. Come out tonight. Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight and dance by the light of moon? Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight. Come out tonight. Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight?